What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, Rabbi's guest is Lawrence Wright, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, journalist, and author of the new Middle East thriller, The Human Scale. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Now that the raucous Jewish holiday of Purim has passed, we can begin to focus on the coming Festival of Freedom, Passover, or Pesach, which begins 4 weeks from, well, last night. This year, the holiday has a particular resonance for American Jews. We are in a very strange period in American history. When it appears freedoms and liberties and rights we believe were inherent in our country are being trampled on daily. And the primary Jewish story is the liberation from slavery in Egypt in all of our history, and the triumph of an ethical civilization over the brutal oppression of autocratic, delusional tyrants. Distressingly, over the past 2 months, we've witnessed the President of the United States literally call himself a king and act as though he had the authority to destroy many of the institutions that have made this a great nation, and particularly a great nation for Jews, the rule of law, the independence of oversight committees and commissioners, the separation of powers in our government, the professionalism of our armed forces, the professionalism, quality, and transparency of our scientific and health-related institutions, the protection of our air, water, and food supplies, the value of crucial alliances and treaties. The president has acted in ways that seem deliberately designed to destroy American economic vitality. He has already created greater unemployment and inflation. The president has targeted with hateful, vitriolic rhetoric every vulnerable group imaginable, nearly, from immigrants to the impoverished to the physically impaired. We have seen Nazi salutes flashed by the tycoon who heads the new unsanctioned department working to rapidly destroy our own government and its services. We have watched as the vice president embraced and touted the neo-Nazi party in German elections. We have seen the president and the partisan appointees he's put in place abandon and attack our closest allies, and instead embrace our most vicious and evil enemies. Domestically, he has freed from prison violent, convicted criminal insurrectionists who literally attacked police officers. He has fired, sued, harassed, even arrested those who have committed the apparent offense of opposing him or his actions publicly. And, of course, he has lied publicly, continuously, and without limit, unwilling or unable to tell the truth about, well, anything. Freedom of speech for anyone opposing the president and his often execrable allies is being curtailed, including the right to protest, while constraints on hate speech for those who support the president are simultaneously evaporating. My friends, this is recognizable as tyranny. It should be familiar to anyone with even a passing acquaintance with the history of fascism, including the way that Hitler destroyed democracy in 1930s Germany in just a few weeks, also after narrowly winning an election just like our president did. And the methods employed should seem familiar too. Intimidation, public attack, vilification, thugs threatening those who oppose even the most egregiously immoral acts of the administration, and ravings about capturing territory and natural resources from nearby peaceful nations that have always been close allies. We have watched the opposition party to this blatant tyranny respond tepidly, if at all. Some of this, of course, is fear. American senators of the president's own party who oppose even the most egregiously unqualified of the president's cabinet appointments sometimes found themselves receiving documented death threats to themselves and their families. We Jews know tyranny. We have seen it unleashed against us in so many nations throughout history. From the Pharaoh in Egypt, to the Assyrians, to the Babylonians, to Haman in Persia, to Antiochus at Hanukkah, to Roman generals and Byzantine emperors, popes in Rome, the pogroms of Khmelnytsky, the Crusaders, the Tsars of Russia, Hitler, Stalin, Brezhnev, the Assads in Syria, the Mullahs in Iran. All tyrants are bad news. Inevitably, they are always, always bad for the Jews, too. We are grateful, of course, that for the moment, opposition to anti-Semitism in support of Israel seemed to be part of the president and his administration's agenda. But we have seen so many untrustworthy acts perpetrated by this president, so much instability that one can only suspect that these positions too may prove to be, what's the word people like so much these days, transactional? That is, not in the long run anything we Jews can truly rely on. Tyranny and the concomitant denial of civil rights, the destruction of the foundation of a society that protects its weakest members, all in favor of pandering to the wealthiest and most powerful people, that does not end well. It cannot end well. It has barely begun, and it is already garnering disastrous results. It is our fervent belief that speedily and soon a new Moses will arise here in the United States to stand up to the new tyrant and to contest the evil decrees promulgated daily. This new pharaoh, this megalomaniac tyrant, will only back down from his full-speed efforts to take full control of the nation when resistance to tyranny is explicit, moral, and powerful. There is no positive plan coming from this administration, but the accrual and accumulation of power and attention. There's no decency here, no morality, no moral principles in evidence at all. This erratic tyranny is partially the creation of chaos for chaos' sake, but in a larger sense, it is employing all the levers of the considerable power of the office to gain ever more control over everything, to squash dissent behind a curtain of fear. It is terribly dangerous for our nation, our way of life, our values. It is profoundly dangerous for our world and for the future of our planet. In this season, when we Jews explore and evaluate the meaning of freedom, we must understand that our own freedoms here in America were hard won. They must not be given up. They must not be constrained, delimited, damaged without a dedicated fight. If we have learned something crucial from our long and often tortured Jewish history, it is this. We must stand up against tyranny. We must fight bullies. We must resist and do so as early in the process of rising authoritarianism as we can. Because if we do not do so, we will eventually find ourselves in the same crosshairs as every other minority group in our society. As we begin to approach the season of Passover, the Zman Chirutenu, we need to work with energy and commitment to counter the rising fascism in America. The future of our nation, best place our people has ever found in the Western world, perhaps in the whole world, is very much at stake. The future of the world and the health of our planet is also very much at stake. Playing possum, lying down and avoiding conflict, waiting for this bizarre tyrant to fail of his own accord is the kind of thing many in Germany did in the 1930s. To quote Edmund Burke, all that's required for the triumph of evil is for good people to do nothing. In this time of year, when we Jews celebrate freedom, if we wish to retain our American freedom, we must begin seriously to resist the tyranny being unleashed on our nation, and do so in word and deed. On a more upbeat note, play us in this morning as part of our pre-Passover preview of Pesach songs. Here's the great cantor, past guest of Two Jewish, Alberto Mizrahi, singing cantor Moshe Oysher's classic version of Chad Gad Yoh, the song at the end of the Passover Seder.
Chad Gad Yoh. Sus el lord mover my dinum cargadio cargare a pre pre no vere 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 vere
Now that's a cantor. That was Chazan Alberto Mizrahi singing Chag Gadya for Passover, coming up in just 4 weeks. Time to get going, cleaning and cooking for Pesach, or at least inviting people to come. Make your reservations now for Seder Up, Congregation Beit Simcha's first night Passover Seder, Saturday night, April 12th at 6:30 p.m. at Beit Simcha, 12111 North La Jolla, led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. It's the best way to celebrate the great Freedom Festival of Passover in song, story, delicious food, and wine. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org for more information and to sign up. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Beit Simcha's first Seder, April 12th. We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish our guests this morning, Lawrence Wright, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, renowned journalist, playwright, and now the author of several really good fiction books, having started in nonfiction. His book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11, won a Pulitzer, was nominated for a National Book Award. His book on Scientologists, Going Clear, was also nominated for a National Book Award. It's just a matter of time, right, isn't it, for that?
And they have me in their sights, I guess.
His new book is a remarkable thriller called The Human Scale. It's set in Israel. The protagonists are extraordinary. Tell us how you conceived of this book.
Well, in a way, been my whole career getting to this book. I was thinking about that the other day. I started out as a teacher in Cairo teaching English to kids at the American University. And then I came back and started working for the Race Relations Reporter in Nashville. So conflict was always a part of my interest. Then, you know, I wrote a movie called The Siege, which was about terrorism. And all these things were converging. And I kept going back to the Middle East. it was a recurring interest for me. And I was, the first time I was in Israel was in 1997. And I was on a State Department tour, you know, it was a publishing package, and we were in Cairo and Jerusalem. And I hired a guide to take me to Hebron. And despite all the conflict I had seen covering race relations in America, I had never seen the degree of antagonism that I saw there. And so that was always in my mind. And so after many years of talking to people in the West Bank and the Arab world and Israel, I decided that I would try to understand it through fiction, which was new for me. And I tried to explain the Middle East to the world and to myself for years. But I decided that maybe the best way of approaching it is through a novel, using representative characters. Yossi Ben-Gal is a deputy chief of police in Hebron, and he's a tough guy. He's been through the IDF. He had to handle the both intifadas. He's seen the rough side of human nature, and he believes so strongly that Israel is the only safety for Jews. And then Anthony Malik is a Palestinian-American FBI agent, modeled on several individuals that I knew who were Arab members of the FBI in the U.S. And he had never actually been to the West Bank, where his family was from, but he had an opportunity to go to a cousin's wedding. So those are the characters. They're bound together by a crime. And this crime, initially, Yossi thinks that Malik might be the
suspect. He's the chief suspect initially.
Right. And then they, you know, because his cousin and their family gets implicated in this crime, Malik has to help out. So the two of these men who are separated by the tides of history and ethnicity and culture are forced together. And the question that the book asks the reader is, can they get along? Can they learn to trust each other?
It's a fascinating premise and a terrific read. That was just a teaser. We'll talk much more about the human scale with Larry Wright when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in Northwest Tucson, the Catalina Foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter and spring. Established 6 years ago by terrific congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive Congregation, Northwest Tucson and the Foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services Friday night at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Saturday morning, Torah study is at 9 a.m. Services are at 10 a.m. Or come to services on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in person in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is available for school-age children and grandchildren. Join us for Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Seder up. Join us at Beit Simcha, our fantastic first night Passover Seder, Saturday night, April 12th, 6:30 p.m. Led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, celebrate the great Festival of Freedom with song, story, a delicious dinner catered by Catalina Caterers, including Prime Rib, a deep exploration of the meaning of liberty today, all led by me. It's less than a month from now. Sign up. First night's Passover Seder at Beit Simcha. Details are at BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. Our musical services are available there, but of course in person. And all of our Adult Education Academy classes are taught live and on Zoom. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for more information about Beit Simcha to come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and our first night Passover Seder on April 12th. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the most dynamic Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. My friends, if you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail, or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, it's a very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, Corner Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments help. Well, we have a first on 2Jewish for you this morning, a first in our 22 years of hosting 2Jewish. We're going to play a bit of the audio version of our guest Lawrence Wright's book, The Human Scale. Enjoy.
The bomb that didn't go off was aboard a United Airlines flight from Jordan's Queen Alia International Airport, bound for JFK. It was another sweltering day in the hottest year on record, and the temperature inside the plane was insufferable. The pilot promised the rested passengers that the air conditioning would kick in after takeoff, but a sandstorm suddenly swept out of the desert, pounding the windows like a desiccated hurricane and leaving the aircraft stranded at the end of the runway. The plane heaved. Passengers swooned. Eventually, maintenance called the plane back to the gate, and United scrambled to ready another aircraft, which would have to come from Cairo when the storm passed. Some of the passengers bailed out, but most hung around the terminal, drinking cocktails in the bar, watching the sun surrender to a dust-choked sky. It wasn't until the luggage was transferred to the new aircraft that a detection dog froze in front of a metal suitcase. Instead of barking or nosing the offending article, which would alert his handler to drugs, the dog sat and stared, as he had been trained to do in case of explosives. Any slight movement could set off the bomb. Within minutes, the airport was evacuated. Because of a gas leak, passengers were told, so they stood in the parking lot shielding their faces against the stinging sand and cursing their luck. Nobody knew that they might all be dead now, their bodies shredded by the blast and scattered across the Mediterranean somewhere near the boot of Italy. The bomb squad arrived an hour later with a portable X-ray machine, which revealed the commonality of modern improvised explosives: batteries and copper wiring, and what could be an altimeter, designed to trigger the bomb when the plane reached a specified altitude. The device was implanted in what looked, in the ghostly thermal image, like a stuffed animal. It was surrounded by powder-filled packets and nails tightly crammed in, a huge bomb, far larger than anything needed to bring down an airplane. The nails were a stylistic addition, useful only for killing crowds, not for knocking planes out of the sky. The squad carefully loaded the suitcase into a globe-shaped containment vessel in an armored Humvee, which slowly made its way on the blocked-off Highway 45 to Zarqat. There, between the National Police Academy and the town dump, was a counter-terrorism center run by Jordanian authorities in conjunction with the FBI. The Humvee passed through the gates of the dump and slowed to a near stop, navigating the potholes with fearful caution, then parking in front of a small cement block building the color of a tangerine. Inside the counterterrorism center, a team of American and Jordanian intelligence watched on video as the bomb disposal technician fitted up. The bomb suit, weighing nearly 100 pounds, was made of Kevlar and flame-resistant Nomex with a ceramic plate to cover the torso. The polycarbonate helmet was equipped with amplifiers and a defogger lit within so that the technician's face, known to everyone in the center, glowed eerily bright. He was Adnan, who was studying electrical engineering and coached a youth soccer team, but they did not refer to him by name. He was too deep in the death zone for anyone to save him, so they called him the guy, as if using his name was bad luck. Not a single person watching in the center had the nerve to do what the guy was doing. It was like watching a man on a tightrope crossing a rocky abyss 1,000 meters deep.
That was an audio sample of Lawrence Wright's The Human Scale. We'll hear more from our guest and get the old Jewish joke of the week when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen. 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So Israel is a close ally of the United States, and we have considered it to be such for a long time, but it's not by treaty, and that's a distinction that maybe you, with your extensive State Department experience, can explain to us.
Well, it's really not very complicated, so I'll make it quick and simple. This is the dummy's guide to treaties.
Useful for me, yeah.
So NATO stands for, it's an acronym, as most things are in government, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So it's an organization of signatories to the North Atlantic Treaty, which was concluded at the end of World War II when the Soviet Union was the enemy. Of course, Germany had been the enemy too, but Germany quickly became one of the central main actors in NATO. And the treaty spells out a number of obligations, and at least in the case of the U.S. and several other countries, has to be ratified by the parliament in a given capital. It's not just a question of sentiment or the particular feelings of one president or one segment of the population. I mean, Israel has long been a strong ally of the U.S., and we've been close, but we're not. There are no like binding legal instruments like there are for the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Now, the thing that is of most concern to most people about NATO is Article 5, which states that an attack on any NATO member will be viewed as an attack on all of NATO members, and all of NATO members will come to the defense of the country that is attacked. Well, so far in all the years since World War II, that article has been invoked only once, and it was invoked by the United States in the wake of 9/11, when in fact our NATO allies all over Europe sent troops to Afghanistan in a misguided effort to, like, okay, the people involved in the 9/11 weren't Afghans, and the Afghan state hardly existed. But anyway, they came to our defense. They honored their commitments to Article 5. And there's concern about the security implications and the economic financial implications of honoring Article 5. And, you know, one candidate for president some number of years ago, who will remain nameless, said, if you expect me to pay to go to the defense of Montenegro, if God forbid it ever joins NATO, you're crazy.
So, in effect, it's a binding agreement, Article 5, to go to the defense of any NATO country if it's attacked.
Well, the whole treaty is a binding international legal instrument. But that particular article is the one that most people are most sensitive to because of the implications it has for armed forces and expenses and budgets and all that.
Well, we will definitely continue to explore these concepts when we come back next week. Tom, thanks for clearing that up, and we will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Max is crossing the street one day. He's hit by a bus. He's immediately rushed to the hospital and put into an intensive care unit. A few days later, his best friend Herschel visits him. So how are things, Max? Herschel asks. Not so good, says Max. My wife Leah visits me 3 times a day. What's bad about that? Asks Herschel. Well, every time she comes, says Max, she sits at my bedside and reads to me. Well, that sounds nice, says Herschel. What does she read to you? And Max answers, my life insurance policy. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Vayakhel deals with the creation of the tabernacle in the wilderness, the consecration of the first central worship sanctuary for the people of Israel. Vayakhel et ha'am, the text has it. Moses assembled the people, called them together, asked them on God's behalf to bring forward the finest objects they possessed in order to create the tabernacle, in which the whole people could worship God in holiness. And the people gave of the best they had. Gold and silver, precious stones, materials used to create a beautiful sanctuary, one they would be proud of, one which they believed would lend itself to the perpetuation of beauty and sanctity. Then Moses invited those artisans, wise in the ways of working with beautiful items, to come forward, to create a structure embodying what God saw as appropriate for a sanctuary. In particular, Moses explained, God has called by name a man named Bezalel from the tribe of Judah, whom God filled with the Spirit of the Lord in wisdom, understanding, knowledge, and all manner of skilled work. He is filled with the wisdom of the heart, that he might teach and work with every wise-hearted person in this sacred work. When their work was complete, they had created a tabernacle, God immediately filled with the Shekhinah, the divine presence, a place of profound sacredness for our ancestors. You know, I love that phrase for those skilled in the work of hands. Wise-hearted men and women who create beauty and elegance to serve God in this world. Each of us has different skills. Some sing, some dance, some speak eloquently. Some of us create works of art and practical beauty with our hands. Each of us can contribute to the creation of holiness in this world by applying those skills to holy work. When we do, we too have the potential to bring God's presence into our midst, into our ordinary, practical world, and so make it sacred. May we each use our own skills this week to make our lives and our world a little better, a little more holy. When we come back in a moment, our guest, Lawrence Wright, the outstanding Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, explains how he came to conceive of the complicated characters in his new novel about Israelis and Palestinians, how October 7th, 2023 changed it. His book is called The Human Scale. Hear all about it when we return in a moment right here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
Israel announced last week it was going to defend Syria's Druze community following days of violence that led to mass killings in Syria of another religious minority, the Alawites, by government forces of the new regime. The violence started last week. It was between fighters linked to Syria's new government and forces loyal to ousted dictator Bashar al-Assad. Israeli government spokesperson David Mentzer described the violence as a massacre of civilians, well, it was, and said Israel was prepared, if needed, to defend the Druze. The Druze are Arabs who practice a religion sometimes considered an offshoot of Islam. There are minority Druze communities in Israel, Syria, and Lebanon. Syria's Islamist-led government said it completed a military operation against a nascent insurgency last week. The violence centered around coastal provinces where most of Syria's Alawite minority live. Assad himself is an Alawite, an offshoot of Shia Islam, whose family for decades brutally ruled over the Sunni Muslim majority in Syria, often massacring some of them. British-based war monitoring group the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said that almost 1,000 civilians were murdered by government forces and allied fighters in reprisal killings. More than 250 Alawite fighters were killed, and more than 230 members of government security forces were killed in the initial fighting. Israel has always had a small Druze community, well, not that small, which has been loyal to Israel and serves in the Israeli military. There have been Druze members of Knesset, including past guests of Too Jewish. There are about 24,000 Druze currently living in the Golan Heights, right next to Syria. Recently, they have, for the first time since 1967, had the opportunity to reconnect with family members living on the Syrian side of the border. Many Syrian Druze have family in the Golan Heights. Last week, Israel announced it will allow Syrian Druze to work in the Golan. On March 1st, Israel announced Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and Defense Minister Israel Katz instructed the Israeli military to be ready to defend a Druze town in the suburbs of Damascus from Syrian government forces. Israel has also provided extensive humanitarian aid to Syrian Druze. Its jets have flown demonstration sorties to provide protection to the endangered communities of Druze in Syria. In other news, acting on decades of reform ambitions, the Trump administration is dramatically scaling back the Federal Department of Education, working to end it. It has also deeply scaled back the Civil Rights Office at the Education Department, which had gone into high gear addressing anti-Semitism at colleges and public schools. Staffing at the Office of Civil Rights, which handles complaints filed under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, is among the casualties of the Trump administration's mass firings. According to Chalkbeat, an education news site, half the 12 regional civil rights offices are being eliminated. There is only a skeleton crew remaining in major offices in New York City, Boston, and San Francisco. The Office of Civil Rights handles discrimination claims against schools. It has been a central source of recourse for Jewish and pro-Israel students whose rights have been infringed upon by pro-Palestinian campus protests since October 7, 2023. The office has opened dozens of Israel-related civil rights investigations into these pro-Palestinian terrorist actions, including several since President Trump's inauguration. Amid vows by both Biden and Trump administrations to protect Jewish students on campus. Last week, the Office of the Education Department sent letters to 60 colleges and universities, warning them they would face consequences if they did not fulfill their responsibility to protect Jewish students. And now those offices have been, well, nearly destroyed. Critics of the Civil Rights Office have always charged its investigations take too long and result in inadequate changes. When Trump took over, watchdogs said they expected the Department of Justice would be a likely new home for campus civil rights issues, including Title VI, if the Education Department was shrunk or closed. Trump's Attorney General, Pam Bondi, has vowed a hardline approach against campus pro-Palestinian terrorist protesters. The Education Department's announcement of the overhaul said it would continue to deliver on all statutory programs that fall under the agency's purview, but it did not mention the Civil Rights Office. The department administers federal funding for schools serving students from low-income families and for students with special needs. It also manages federal student loans for college students. No word on what will happen if the department is annihilated. And that's the Too Jewish News of Jews Round the World.
We
welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. He's the extraordinary writer Lawrence Wright, renowned journalist, nonfiction author, winner of the Pulitzer Prize, twice nominated for a National Book Award for nonfiction. His new book is fiction. And as we discussed at the beginning of the show, The Human Scale is an attempt to understand the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, maybe the whole Middle East, through the lens of fiction. Both of these characters are powerful and, of course, flawed, because they're always more interesting if they're flawed, right?
So you got to have weaknesses and strengths in some balance in order for the character to be plausible for the reader.
You know, you talked about how you were drawn to conflict. Well, the West Bank sure is a perfect place for that. I've been in Hebron. I went first in 1976 when I was just a kid. I went back most recently in 2015. It is a strange place and tense, like all the time, isn't it?
It is. It seems to be in some ways, it's a pioneer in the settlement movement. And, it's always been a hotbed. You know, it's got a large contingent of IDF soldiers to protect them. But, there's a lot of raids that come out of Kiryat Arba, mainly the main settlement there.
In creating these characters, did you base them on people you knew?
Yes, to some extent. You know, I drew from personalities that I've been acquainted with over the decades. And so for the most part, they're a melange of different people, but they're informed by all these relationships that I've developed over the years.
Well, you know, this is a probably poorly understood fact that there's actually, in the midst of all this conflict, quite a lot of cooperation between the Palestinian Authority police and the various Israeli military and police entities. So the idea that an American FBI agent, somewhat discredited, I might add, hope I'm not giving away too much of the book, would end up working with the Israeli police. It's not a particularly strange idea, I think, anybody who's been over there.
Well, in fact, the New York Police Department has aides in Israel and the region. Not just FBI, LEGATs, and so on, but actually, you know, the police department in New York, which sees a link to some of the activity, the criminal activity and the terrorism in the region reflected in New York.
You are maybe one of the world's experts on Al-Qaeda. How do you see the relationship of Islamic extremism with what's going on in the West Bank and Gaza?
Well, modern terrorism really was born with the creation of Israel and the dispersal of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. And, you know, the region now is awash in refugees, not just from the West Bank and Gaza and so on, but Syria and Lebanon. And it's more refugees in the world at any time, more than after World War II. And, you know, the sense of dispossession and distress in that, you know, poorly cared for, poorly educated population is so great. There's a direct link to the rise of terrorism. You know, I think this is something that people don't entirely appreciate, because we pay for this in one way or another. And terrorism will always be a factor when you have people who are dispossessed and in despair.
When I was over in southeastern Turkey in 2015, it was kind of at the height of Al-Qaeda. There were, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of refugees from Syria that were in Turkey, and a lot of them are still there. How did this kind of permanent refugee population, this seems to be the new trend in a weird way.
Well, you know, they often find their way blocked. For instance, you know, there are Palestinian refugees all over the Middle East and, of course, elsewhere, but most of the countries that accept them don't give them full citizenship. Jordan's an exception. But, you know, the sheer numbers can capsize. You know, like Jordan is nearly it's a majority Palestinian, and it's
sure,
a very carefully balanced state. You know, Lebanon at one point had like a third of the Syrian population in it. And there are these immense refugee camps that have been spawned since ISIS. And really, the world is not paying attention to them. And so I'm, you know, from strictly through the lens of terror, you know, I worry about this. And it's one of the things I tried to reflect in the novel, that, you know, this violence is, you know, there's underneath it is this sense of grievance and despair and hostility and all that manifested in the hatred you see so plainly in that region.
In your book, obviously it starts out with great hostility between Yossi and Malik. In creating that relationship, what were you trying to accomplish?
Well, I wanted two interesting men, very similar in some respects, but separated by their past, and plunged into a dilemma, this project that's been going on in the Middle East since 1948, but has never been resolved. And so the question is, you know, here are two men, both of them appealing in some way. They're tough guys, but they have a sense of honor. And if they can't make peace, then who can? And this is, you know, this constantly in the novel, I was erecting the most severe boundaries. You know, they were pulled apart by so much. The forces expelling them from this friendship are so great, it's hard to imagine they could overcome it. But on the other hand, they have a sense of decency, and they've come to recognize the humanity in the other. And that's, you know, when that happens, they are able to trust each other, and they're able to resolve their differences in the face of all this conflict.
It seems like every time in not only the West Bank, in Gaza, in the Middle East, where there are dramatic steps towards peace, terrorism intrudes and blows it all up.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, I think October 7th was an example of that, because Israel and Saudi Arabia were perched on the edge of making a historic settlement that would have made a profound difference in the Middle East, except for the Palestinian question, which, you know, the Abraham Accords simply jumped over. But just like with Oslo, just like with Camp David, you can go back to each of these instances where there was possibility for a peaceful settlement, and it is always subverted by one or both sides.
In, I think, 96 or so, I went on a rabbinic mission during the Oslo process, and we sat in Gaza City meeting with Jibril Rajoub, who was head of security, and they talked about the cooperative patrols that were being done by Israelis and Palestinians then, and there was just this incredible wide-eyed sense of optimism. That seems like 1,000 years ago now.
Well, that was, you know, I've been through cycles of, you know, the situation in Gaza and the West Bank. And the novel depicts the days before October 7th.
Right.
And I have to confess, I had already written the novel before October 7th. I had turned in a first draft in August of 2023. And it ended with a war, ironically. But it wasn't at the scale of devastation as October 7th. So I had to go back and confront it. I thought I could go back in history and write it, or I could go forward into the future, but finally I realized this was a challenge, and I had to, the novel was waiting there as a way of seeing the development of this horrible tragedy.
It's horrible indeed, and the impact is profound. Did it make you rethink aspects of the novel earlier?
Yeah, I had to take a lot of things into account. The barbarity of that action, you know, was shocking, although given the context, in some ways not surprising. But
isn't it awful to have to say that?
I know. Well, there's a phrase that in Israel, I've forgotten the Hebrew word, but it's the concept. This concept that you only had to mow the lawn every few years and tamp down the extremists, it doesn't work. But I think one of the things I had to do in the novel after October 7th is go back and examine the intelligence agencies inside Israel. Some of my characters work in Shin Bet or Mossad, and there was a colossal failure. And it was made more so by the fact that the plans, the Joshua plan, as they called it, was in the hands of Israeli intelligence. Every single detail of what actually transpired was a plan that the Israeli Shin Bet had all along. And they couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe what was in front of their eyes. And I had to go back and account for that. And then also, I had dealt with Hamas in the first draft, but I hadn't dealt as completely with the terror edge of it. And so I had to go back and examine that as well. I had, you know, talked to Hamas. I'd been to Gaza after Operation Cast Lead. with all the things that are said about Hamas, one thing people don't normally talk about is how naive they are. And the organization from the beginning is partly a result of this isolation culturally and politically. You know, that is one of the consequences, is that, you know, the unrealistic nature of that organization, but also the dedication to it, which we saw on October 7th.
Yeah, it's a very dangerous combination. I feel like we could keep talking for a long time, and the book is extraordinary. Was it difficult to complete?
Let me say this. It was wrenching. It was wrenching. And, you know, I had characters that I had to sacrifice. And, you know, as novelists tend to fall in love with their characters. And I still, you know, Dickens was famous for weeping when he had to kill Little Nell. You know, I'm sympathetic to those tears. There was a lot of bloodshed, and that had to be represented in the book as well.
I want to thank Lawrence Wright for a great visit here on Too Jewish. It's a terrific book, and it explores one of the most profound and powerful and difficult conflicts of all, the conflict in between Israel and the Palestinians. The book is called The Human Scale. Where can people go to find out more about you, Larry, and about your work?
Well, lawrencewright.com is my website. And, you know, also Goodreads and Amazon both have information. And the book is coming out soon, but you can order it on Amazon already. So I hope I'll find some readers in Tucson.
I expect you will. Hopefully we'll get you here at the book fair one of these days. And
I hear good things about that book fair. So yes, I'd like that.
It's an excellent book fair. I'm moderating something there. I will definitely put you in anyway. I hope to see you locally. Thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Todd Rockoff, Executive Director and CEO of the Tucson Jewish Community Center, explaining what the JCC Maccabiah Games are and the incredible impact they have on a community, including ours here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, since they are coming this summer. Join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, every Friday night. Services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading in Kiddush, in person, and on our Facebook page. Our playout today on Too Jewish is for the coming Festival of Passover. Sign up now, our incredible first night Seder at Beit Simcha, Saturday night, April 12th at 6:30 p.m., Seder Up. Led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Songs, stories, fabulous food, rituals, both new and traditional. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675 to sponsor and sign up for our first night's Pesach Seder. Our playout today comes from Sephardic Israeli icon Yehoram Gaon, a beautiful version of Adir Hu from the Songs of the Seder for Pesach. My friends, have a Shavuot Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Adiru, adiru, even beito bekaro, bimhera, bimhera, beyaminu bekaro, el bene, bene beitcha bekaro, bimhera, bimhera, beyaminu bekaro. Adiru, adiru, even beito bekarov, bimhera, beyaminu bekarov, el bene, bene beitcha bekarov, bimhera, beyaminu bekarov.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.